everyone out there in Nikon land. This is The Image Doctors, episode number 63 for April 3rd, 2008. I'm Jason O'Dell.
And I'm Rick Walker.
And thanks again for joining us on our bi-weekly foray into all things photography.
Yep.
What do we got today, Rick?
Well, several topics. We haven't talked about Think Tank stuff in a while, and we're going to talk a little bit about their new hydrophobia lens cover for shooting in the rain, which is oriented against longer lenses. And then since we're talking about shooting in the rain and things like that, we'll talk a little bit about shooting in bad weather, rain, snow, approaches, why you would do that, what you can use to avoid screwing up your equipment, and how you can stay comfortable too, which is probably the more important
thing. Right.
And then after that, we're going to talk a little bit about scouting out locations, both for landscape type work as well as wildlife. You know, what are some of the preparatory things that you can do, some of the things that you should think through. And then we'll end up with a short prescription, as always.
Okay. So I think we'll start with just the whole topic of shooting in less than perfect weather.
Mm-hmm.
And this comes up a lot, especially in the wintertime, but also if you live in a place where you can have rain. Weather is just one of those things. And I think the first temptation is to just not shoot in it at all.
Right.
And it gets to be, well, I just won't go out today. And there's a lot of times where that's a perfectly valid reason
right.
not to go out. But there's other times where you can get some pretty unique images just by going out in the weather. And one nice thing about it, if you think about it, a lot of people aren't out there in the weather. So chances are if you go somewhere, you might see something and get an image that's different than somebody else's image.
Right. And there's another practical reason to do it too. And that's that you may be on the trip of a lifetime and you're only going to have one day in a location. And guess what? It's raining that day.
Right.
So you can either not do any photography at all ever at that place, or, you know, get out there and do some potentially interesting things.
Yeah, a good example was the Nikonians Ampat last year.
Mm-hmm.
Where our group, we had not bad weather, but there was some snow and there was times when it was, well, do you just not go out? No, you do it anyway. You march on and you persevere.
Yeah.
And so it's good to be prepared in those kinds of situations.
Yeah, and on the same trip, you know, we had, you know, one day, you know, a lot of snow coming down first thing in the morning. And what did we do? We got in our van and headed for Hayden Valley. And we had just an outstanding morning of shooting out in the snow and just fantastic stuff. Just fantastic. So, sometimes you have to embrace what's going on out there, go after it. So lots of good reasons to do it.
So let's talk about first things first is, protecting, you know, what kind of gear to bring and how to protect your gear.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll talk about how to protect yourself and move from there. So the first thing, if you're going to be shooting in any kind of weather where it might be raining or maybe spray or snow, anything wet, you're going to want to protect your camera and your lens from getting too wet. And there's a lot of different ways to protect your camera on a lot of different budgets.
Mm-hmm.
But the simplest way is get some kind of plastic or some kind of lens/camera hood, something that you can put over the camera to keep it from getting rained on. And the trick with these is that you want to make sure that whatever you end up using, it's easy to pack. You can put it on, take it on and put it off, take it on and off your camera and lens easily enough.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully it allows you to actually use your camera in the weather. It's not a whole, you could put a hefty bag over your camera, but you can't see what you're doing. So it gets tricky to use. And so there's some low tech solutions to this and there's some high tech solutions to this. And there's a range of options.
And a lot of it depends on how nasty the weather really is.
Correct.
Is it just, you know, a little bit of mist and occasional raindrops, or is it just a torrential tropical downpour?
Right. So let's start with your gear itself. Uh-huh. If you're using some of the higher end Nikon camera bodies, they have pretty good weather sealing on it.
Right.
That's not to say you can dump a bucket of water on it, but just kind of light rain or mist, something that's not heavy, probably is not going to get in there.
Right.
You're going to be okay.
And so, you know, just to give some specifics, if you're shooting with something like a D300, a D3, one of the D2 series, the D200 to a certain extent, you're going to be in pretty good shape with those. They've got, you know, some weather sealing in there that's pretty good, especially on the newer ones. And, you know, I've had mine out in light rain, no problem. The lenses you have to be a little bit more sensitive to, because there are a few, you know, just a small number that have kind of like an O-ring at the back and some
internal
sealing.
I'm looking
at
my 18 to 200 VR, and it actually has that little O-ring.
Does it really?
Mm-hmm. So it's an extra level of weather sealing just to keep light amount of keeps moisture from getting mm-hmm. into where the bayonet mount is, mm-hmm. Where your electrical contacts are. Most of the higher end, especially things like the 70 to 200 VR, those lenses will have that O-ring, and you mm-hmm. can just check it's on the F mount on the lens itself.
Mm-hmm. Still, the lenses are going to be a little bit more sensitive to moisture than those cameras I mentioned, but you don't need to be obsessive about it.
Now, does this mean like a D70 isn't weatherproof?
No, I mean you can be out shooting with a D70 in light rain and you're fine too. You know what I would suggest is if you're going to be doing that, just take along a little towel or something like that periodically, give it a wipe, those kind of things.
Right. So there's a difference between weather resistant and weatherproof. Most of the higher end Nikon bodies are weather sealed to a certain degree, mm-hmm. but again, that's not gonna prevent you from having potential issues in a torrential downpour,
right.
or something like that. So then you can move to the other things you should always, before I move on to the ways of protecting it, you're going to want to for sure use your lens hood,
yeah,
because that's going to keep moisture rain off the lens surface itself. Mm-hmm. And depending on what kind of environment you're in, if you're in a saltwater spray environment, here's where something like a UV filter is going to, where a protective filter mm-hmm. function is useful,
because
you keep the salt water off of the front element of your lens.
Right. And it's not a bad thing if it's really raining hard too, and you've got a lens hood that's not particularly deep, you know, like the one that you might find on a wide angle zoom, you know, for instance. So that is, you know, one time that I'll use them. I don't use them too terribly often in general.
Now moving into the discussion of actual rain covers for your mm-hmm. gear, the simplest one is some tip I read one place. Maybe it was in a John Shaw book or something. It's the hotel shower cap approach.
Yeah,
that works really well if in a pinch. And what's great about it is that it's easy to pack.
Yeah.
But a little bit higher tech than that is there's a variety of manufacturers out there that make small rain covers mm-hmm. with drawstrings on either end, so you can cinch one end around the lens mm-hmm. and the other end closes down around the camera body.
Right.
And you pointed out a really good one that you've had for a while, right?
Uh-huh.
And why don't you tell me about that one?
Yeah, it's a company called Photosharp, and it's photosharp.com. So if you go to their website and just look under rain covers, you'll find that they've got several different types. And they're really just one step fancier than the hotel shower cap. Not that that's a bad thing. I mean, they're just simple plastic covers, and they do have something up front to cinch up on the lens, and then a draw string on the back.
And, so they're open on either end.
Yeah, you can actually shoot with them on, as opposed to the shower cap thing, which is something that you just put on and off, you know, when you're taking a shot. So you can actually shoot in the rain, see through the cameras, see through the viewfinder, get to the camera controls, all those kind of things with these on there. And they're not expensive. They're like $25. They collapse down to a super small size. So it'll just fit into a little pocket in your bag or backpack.
Or in your jacket pocket.
Yeah, any of those things. And you'll just have it in case that there is some bad weather. That's the nice thing. It's just tiny and weighs almost nothing.
I've seen some rain covers that Optek makes. I believe you can buy one on the Nikonian shop.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit more complicated, but same idea. There's sort of a hood. Think of the screens on the TV camera guys. Mm-hmm. If you see the TV cameraman, they have that long extension. Sort of think of it like that, where it extends over the back. I don't have one. I'm not sure how, but they're fairly easy to assemble from what I've heard.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of a more of a rigid approach. That's the kind of thing you're going to use if you're set up in one spot. Maybe you're not moving around. Right. As much. Then there's a couple on the high end. If you want to go all the way high tech, for people who are using their lenses in the torrential downpour, they have and you can't leave. And this would be an example really targeted towards photojournalists or sports photographers. You know, you're on the sideline at a football game and it's raining. Your job is, you're paid to be out there. Well, you can't get your gear wet. So there's a line of covers from a company called Aquatech, mm-hmm. and they're really expensive, but they will cover, they come in different sizes. You can get them to cover 600 F4 with a body attached all the way down to a short zoom, like a 28 to 70 kind of zoom. Mm-hmm. They're very expensive, but they're essentially Gore-Tex with seam sealed. They have a little pocket you can put your hand into and little windows. You can see what you're doing through them. They're a little bit tricky to use because once they're on, you don't really put them on and take them off anymore. And you need to get a little eyepiece to mount. There's a neoprene. The back of the design of these, there's a little neoprene section and then a hole in it. And then you get the eyepiece depending on your camera, mm-hmm. whether it's the screw-in type for something like your D2X or D3. And then there's the slip-on type that you'd use for something like a D70 or a D300, D200. And then Think Tank Photo just came out with a new one, which is designed only for the long lenses. It's right. similar to the Aquatech, but it's a different design. And it's a little bit... it's got some unique properties to it, and it's about half the price of the Aquatech ones.
Right.
So we'll talk about that in the next segment. We'll actually review it because I got one. I think you got one too.
Yeah.
But that's only an option if you're using something like a 300, 400, 500, 600 millimeter lens.
Yeah, and a big 300, you know, like a 2.8. Yeah.
Exactly. Okay, so that's how you protect your camera for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about protecting yourself.
Yeah, because if you're not out there shooting, there's not much point in
and if
protecting
you're not
your camera.
Comfortable, you're not going to want to go out there shooting.
Right.
So the first thing, it's important to look at what kind of clothing you want to have. And I think for any kind of inclement weather, Gore-Tex or Gore-Tex style fabrics, there's a lot of knockoffs that were just not knockoffs. They're
just alternatives.
Alternatives, exactly. Yeah. A different patent, similar concept of breathable, lightweight, breathable fabric.
And the breathability is really important.
Well, growing up in Miami, mm-hmm. and having that yellow raincoat, that rubberized stuff, you'd never want to wear the darn thing because you'd come home and you were just as wet inside as if it wasn't raining because you sweat so much.
Yeah.
And that's awful.
And if you're out there taking photos, chances are you're going to be moving around and, you know, climbing on rocks and, you know, just doing all sorts of things. And if you get all steamed up inside the thing, you're just not going to be comfortable.
Right. So layers are a must, of course. Mm-hmm. And with the Gore-Tex stuff, the waterproof, breathable fabrics that are out there, you can go a lot lighter than you might think because mm-hmm. they tend to be windproof as well in general. So something like a breathable waterproof parka shell or even just a windbreaker that's Gore-Tex would be very good. There's a bunch of different kinds out there. If you go to your local supply store, if you're in the States, REI is really good, mm-hmm. but they're not cheap.
Right.
They're really not cheap. They're actually quite expensive. You can find yourself looking at a $200 jacket sometimes or more.
Easily.
But they do work. They, as advertised, they're really, really good.
Yeah. And you can get rain pants that are made of the same exact material. And don't think about that part of you, too. It may seem like, oh, I really won't get wet because the park is going to kind of shelter me and stuff. You'd be surprised getting a good rainstorm and you'll just be soaked down there if you don't have something.
And I find with the pants, if there's an area where you can skimp, where you don't need to spend on the breathable stuff, the pants is mm-hmm. one way of doing that. You can get some pretty good rain pants that are seam sealed and you can kneel down and stuff and you won't get wet. And you don't sweat as much on your legs, I find, as you do up in your upper body.
No,
so
that's definitely true.
So that's one way of doing it.
Now underneath that shell, you want to think a little bit about what you're wearing too. And there's some good alternatives out there right now. On the lower end, they're just like the fleece jackets, mm-hmm. which are not bad.
No,
they're pretty breathable and they're comfortable and they feel good.
And they're thin.
Right. And you know, if the weather improves and it's not raining anymore, but it's still a little bit cool out, just having that layer is often
helps
enough.
A lot. And one thing I gotten recently, and I think you have one of these or a similar one, mm-hmm. is something called a windstopper jacket.
Right.
And this isn't 100% waterproof, but it's fine for light mist, rain, mm-hmm. that kind of stuff. But what I really like about it is that it's effectively a Gore-Tex fleece jacket. It's not fleece in the same way of, it's not fluffy fleece. It's pretty thin, mm-hmm. but it's got a membrane lining in it. Mm-hmm. And that thing, for as thin as it is remarkably warm because it keeps the wind out.
Right.
And I'll tell you, it works great.
Yeah. And that's the big difference between it and one of the fleece coats. The fleece coats are nice and keep you warm if it's not too windy. But when the wind picks up, you feel it.
So if it's just kind of like a wet day, maybe not a lot of heavy rain or anything where you need to really be bundled up against mm-hmm. the rain, one of these windstopper vests is going to provide enough waterproofing and keep you remarkably warm while staying very lightweight.
Mm-hmm.
It works very good. I used that up in Yellowstone this past year, and I was amazed how much fewer layers I needed.
Right.
By using that.
Yeah, the windstopper stuff is really great.
Again, extremely expensive compared to the regular fleece jackets, but it'll be worth it. It'll be something you can use for a really long time mm-hmm. should you go that way. Now, what if you're really getting into areas where you're near water, and it could be like on a beach and it's raining on the beach? It's not a bad idea to have good boots and maybe even a pair of waders.
Mm-hmm.
Those waterproof pants will help you there too.
Yeah, I remember the last time I was shooting on the Olympic coast, and I've got a trip up there planned at the end of May, so I'll get to do this again. But the last time I was there, it was just a really quick thing. I only had one evening, and I was shooting at Ruby Beach, and I didn't have anything fancy along with me in terms of gear and stuff, weather gear. But there was another photographer out there at the same time, and I was very jealous because he had on a nice pair of waders, and he could just go anywhere out there in the surf and little pools of water and get exactly the shot that he was looking for. And I was kind of stuck to areas with dry land. Yeah. I guess I could have left my shoes, but if you've ever stuck your feet in the
Pacific, it's cold, especially up there.
Yeah. The Northwest. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Your feet will go numb in a few minutes.
That's true. So,
but they,
not something you need normally, but if you're going to one of those locations where that can be useful, a pair of waterproof
boots
is really a must here. And get ones that are high enough so that if, depending on where you're at, if you're stepping in puddles, you're not going to flood your boots.
Right.
And so,
or if you get a little bit too focused on your shot, you fail to notice the water coming in.
Because I'll tell you, wet, cold feet are probably the worst thing to have to deal with out in the field.
Yeah, and they're just going to probably force you into leaving a little bit early and missing some shots.
Now, one thing that you can get if you're not interested in shelling out the big bucks on a set of Gore-Tex boots. They make, at least at one time, I was able to find Gore-Tex oversocks.
Mm-hmm.
So these are just like booties. And you put them on over your socks and then your boots. So, yeah, your boots still get wet, but your feet stay dry on the inside.
Yeah. And actually, I think we're talking about two different things there that probably both deserve a little bit of time. If you're, out in conditions like snow and things like that, the Gore-Tex hiking boots are really nice.
Mm-hmm.
If you're on a beach or something like that, you're probably going to want to go with something more like the rubber boots or wellies or, whatever you want to call them. Because the others won't be high enough and you're almost certain to get, water going down into your feet and ankles and all that kind of stuff. That's where you want to go with the higher ones that come up almost to your knees. So, and those aren't necessarily expensive, by the way. You don't need something really fancy.
Now, they can be a challenge to pack if you have weight restrictions, that's about it.
Yep.
Now, we talked about the bottom. Let's go back upstairs to the gloves mm-hmm. and things you can do on this department. And I'm still searching for the best
me too.
Gloves. I have those nice Hatch makes some good ones, but invariably the problem with gloves is you can get some that are waterproof, but they're too thick. Or you can get some that are really thin and give you good dexterity, but they're just cotton, and then they, as soon as a breeze comes up, your hands get really cold again.
Yeah.
So it's a trade-off between warmth and dexterity. And it's really tough sometimes.
Yeah, and you know what I've been using a lot lately has been a pair of Windstopper gloves. I think the ones I've got are made by Outdoor Research, but there are probably lots of companies that make something similar. And just like with the jackets, the great thing is that they're pretty thin, they're pretty lightweight, yet they stay pretty warm because they are keeping out the wind.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just surprisingly warm, actually. They're not the warmest ones in the world, but they're pretty good. And they're a little bit thinner, so in a lot of situations I can shoot with them on. But I'll tell you, I've had trouble finding a pair of gloves that I could really leave on all the time and still be able to manipulate every control on the camera or be able to mount filters with some confidence and not drop them and things right. like that. It's tough.
One thing that I usually do if it's cold outside or, you know, if I'm going out in the snow is I'll pack a couple of those chemical hand warmers.
Yeah.
And I'll keep those in my pockets because that just really helps, especially if I'm wearing the thin gloves. Then I can stick my hands back in my pockets. And these are those charcoal iron. Well, I don't know what's in them. It's
yeah.
some sort of mixture of iron oxide or iron
typically
sulfate.
They come in a little plastic pouch. They're cheap. They cost just a few dollars.
Yeah, and inside it's like this white US mesh prices. Fabric thing. It's not yeah. fabric. It's a kind of paper.
And you open it up and kind of shake them up a little bit, and then they start warming up, and they stay warm for several hours.
Yeah, most of the ones you can get nowadays for the hand warmers at least can stay warm for, some of them can stay warm for up to 10 hours.
Wow.
But most of them will go for at least about 6 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have thinner ones you can put in your boots even
mm-hmm.
if you want to help keep your feet warm.
Yeah, they work great though. These
they
things
help.
Are so nice when it's really cold out.
Yeah, especially when you're carrying your tripod around and it seems like everything you're hiking around with prohibits you from keeping your hands in your pockets.
Mm-hmm.
And then it also tends to be cold metal things.
Right.
And that sucks the heat right out of your hands.
Yeah. And the last thing is wear a hat, you know, if it's really cold. It doesn't have to be anything fancy, you know, just like a good stocking cap or something like that. If it is raining hard, you know, hopefully your parka has some sort of a hood or something like that. But there's some other varieties of hats that you can wear too that work pretty well.
I like to wear a hat with a brim. If you wear glasses, this is kind of a must
mm-hmm.
because it'll keep the raindrops from getting on your glasses.
Yeah. A particularly nice line of hats for photography are the Tilly hats. It's T-I-L-L-E-Y. And they come in a bunch of different styles, but they're made out of a nylon material that's, you know, pretty darn waterproof. And you're not going to mess them up having them in the rain. And they have pretty good-sized bills on them and stuff that extend out over your neck and shoulders. And you can keep them on while shooting, too. So that might be one to look at.
And you want one that if you're going to have a wide-brimmed hat, you want to make sure that when you're wearing it, it funnels the water off to the back
mm-hmm.
rather than on the front so
right.
that it doesn't drip all over your camera. That's the
right.
idea.
Right.
Okay, we'll move into the last little segment on our inclement weather. Some other things you can some other technical stuff you can think about. If you're shooting in snow or on beaches,
mm-hmm.
Tripods have this tendency of sinking into the snow or into the sand.
Yeah.
And so one accessory you could look into for shooting in snow or on beaches is something called tripod shoes. And they're like little lunar lander feet for the ends of your tripod. And some people, they have, I know John Shaw's book talked about how to make your own set. I think if you're using the Gitzo carbon fiber tripods, it's a little trickier. I think some of the new ones have removable feet so that you can mm-hmm. actually put the little tripod. This is like snowshoes.
Mm-hmm.
So they're just discs and they attach to the bottom of your tripod. And that can help a lot, especially if your tripod has pointy, small, lower segments. That can be an issue. And then what about getting good pictures in the rain or in this kind of overcast weather if it's misty or foggy? There's some conditions you got to be prepared to deal with.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of times, especially like in mist, the if you just go by what your camera meter is saying, you'll get an underexposed shot just because it's got that bright mist in there that's throwing things off. And very often, just opening up about a stop fixes that, and you'll get nice results. But just be aware of it. Otherwise, you know, your images will come back looking pretty dark. And if you're shooting with a digital camera, you know, just take a peek at the histogram. You can tell what's going on, but usually plus one works pretty well in those misty kind of conditions, and even, you know, some rain.
Other things that I've run into, if you're going to be shooting in the rain with a flash, be prepared to see raindrops reflect back at you. Same thing with snow.
So I've seen that.
I wouldn't necessarily recommend this because it just you don't notice them until you take this picture. You see all these bright spots.
It just doesn't
everywhere.
Work too well.
It doesn't work too well. And then another thing to consider is if it is raining or snowing pretty steadily, it doesn't have to be hard, but just it's in the air, it's going to mess up your autofocus potentially. You might not be able to get the kind of autofocus because there's objects basically moving between you and your subject. So be prepared to use manual focus or touch up with manual focus as needed, depending on the conditions. That being said, I've seen some wonderful, wonderful images from that were taken in what would be otherwise considered bad weather.
Yeah.
And get some great shots.
Yeah. And sometimes the even better shots are ones where you're out there, it's bad weather, and then all of a sudden the sun comes out.
I was thinking the exact same thing.
And that transition time is short. You know, you don't have much time. So unless you're out there, you're not going to get that.
You can get those really dark skies before a storm or right after, or the rainbows or whatever comes around.
Gorgeous,
you got to be
stuff.
There. So if you're not out in the weather at the beginning, chances are you'll miss the shot when you hit that transition period.
Yep. All right. Now let's talk about a specific piece of rain gear that we've already hinted at a couple times, which is the Think Tank Hydrophobia 300 to 600, I think is what it's called.
Rain cover.
Which probably hints at the fact that they'll have others for other focal lengths or camera setups, but we don't know for sure.
Yeah, our friends at Think Tank supposedly spent like 18 months developing this thing. But anyway, this is sort of to compete with the Aquatech line of rain covers that I mentioned before. Because I think for serious sideline sports photographers, but also nature photographers, people who are going to be out there where you really need to make sure that your camera is weatherproofed more than just weather resistant, this is an option that you can use. And the way that the Hydrophobia rain cover works is that it's got a couple of Velcro attachments on the front, and you stick it over the barrel end of your lens over the hood, and then you can cinch it down with Velcro. And what's interesting about it is that you can keep it sort of folded up, and there's got a drawstring with an elastic drawstring, and you can keep it on the end of your lens in rolled up until you want to use it.
Yeah, just in case.
Right. So you can put it on the end of the lens. And this is the feature, in my opinion, that distinguishes it from the other products on the market, which pretty much require you to deploy the whole thing out, especially if you're going to be using it on a tripod or a monopod. It can be a challenge to use. If the weather isn't bad, it's a lot easier to shoot without having to have the rain cover on.
Right.
So this one's neat feature, the sort of the killer feature on this rain cover, is the fact that you can roll it up and cinch it into itself and just keep it on the end of your lens. And so that'll work. And we tried this out on the 600 F4, and I tried it out on the 200 to 400 VR.
Right.
And it's a little bit big for the 200 to 400 VR, but it will still fit it.
Right.
So you have to kind of mess with it a little bit, but it will work. It's really designed for the lenses that have the really big hoods, like the 300 2.8, 400 2.8, 500 and 600 F4. Those are the lenses that it's designed to be used on the best. Then when you deploy the rain cover, you stretch it out over the back of your camera, and then just like the Aquatech design, you have a little eyepiece that
right.
you attach, and that creates a nice seal, but it allows you to look through the camera without any hindrance. Then the other design of this, it has two pockets that you can stick your hands into to access. And so I guess if you're good at it, you could actually change a memory card in this because it's got two access ports.
Right.
And then it's got some clear areas so you can see the top and the controls of your camera. I think it's a really nice design. It comes in a little mesh bag, so if it is wet, it'll dry out.
Yeah, and like every other piece of Think Tank gear that I've seen or own, it's very well thought out with lots of clever little touches, and it's very well made, too.
Yeah, one of those little touches, for example, is it's got a little pocket with a Velcro tab on the side that you can put your eyepiece into
right.
so you don't lose it.
Yeah, and that's what they're famous for, those just little touches that really make the stuff nice to use.
But it's a nylon construction. It's seam sealed. They have some videos on their website where they show dumping water out of a bucket on it. Mm-hmm. It won't keep you dry, but it'll keep your camera dry. I think it's a very good product. I haven't had an opportunity to actually use it in weather yet, but it looks like something that's easy to pack, and better yet, it's easy to deploy because you can be prepared with it. You don't have to fumble for it in your bag and then figure out how to get this thing on there with your camera attached to the tripod. It can be a real challenge. Other products I've tried, you had to take the lens off the tripod completely, put the rain hood on, and then mount it on the tripod. And once it's there, it's on there. And and flipping it off, it over to try to, if the rain were to stop, isn't the easiest thing in the world to do. Right. This one's very easy to do that with. I believe it retails for
$150 US,
mm-hmm. which is a lot of money, but at the same time, is about half the price of what the Aquatech stuff go for.
Right.
So for that market segment, I think it's a pretty good value.
It's a good deal. I'm pretty certain.
Who should buy one of these? If you're out there in real rain all the time and you're not going to be somewhere where you can stop shooting or get indoors or your shot depends on you getting it regardless of the weather, then, and you have a big lens, this is a great product for you.
Yeah, and if you compare that $150 to the price of one of those lenses, it's a cheap insurance policy.
That's true, too.
Yeah.
It's very true.
Not only will it protect your lens against, bad things happening to it, but it allows you to use it in conditions that aren't too favorable.
Now, one thing nice about Think Tank is that they're a supporter of the Nikonians website.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go to thinktankphoto.com/Nikonians, you'll get to a special area of their website that allows you to not only any order you place through that link, they will give you usually a freebie Think Tank module, some sort of bonus.
Yeah, it could be a lens case. It varies a little bit.
Depends on the time of year, mm-hmm. but they will do that as a way of showing their thanks to the Nikonians members who support the Think Tank products. So,
A small portion of the purchase also ends up supporting the Nikonian site. So
that's true.
It's a good thing for you.
It's a way that you can help support
several
the Nikonian
ways.
Site.
Yep.
Okay, so I think that pretty much wraps it up.
Mm-hmm.
For the review, a good product. I look forward to not having to use it, but I'm glad that it's there when I need it.
Right.
Last topic we've got for today before our prescription is something that was brought to us. Well, the idea for this topic came from an email that we got from Stan Fong, one of our listeners, and he wanted to know a little bit about the preparations that we go through for a particular shoot, differences between wildlife and landscape photography, how you prepare for a shoot. And what we thought would be, we could expand on that idea a little bit and talk about scouting your locations and whether you're scouting it for wildlife, landscape, or any other kinds of photography, what should you do beforehand and what are the kinds of things you should consider?
Right. And this is something that isn't just the day before or 2 days before. It can be months before. It could be a year before.
This is your long lead planning followed by the short-term stuff.
Right. And for the longer lead planning, it starts with, well, where the heck do you go? You may already have a location in mind, but maybe you don't. And there's some really great resources out there now. Certainly lots of things on the internet that you can use. And you could start just with, basic searches on the kind of photography that you're interested in. But if you have a few ideas, Googling it, getting on our website, the Nikonians website, and doing searches there using the Nikoscope feature are remarkably good. And of course, one of the funny things is if you end up searching on photographic subjects on Google, very often it'll point you toward Nikonians anyway.
Right. And the forums at Nikonians, if you're interested in looking at the, they're a great place to ask questions about where did you get that shot.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is see the images that you like in books, mm-hmm. and then see where they were made.
Mm-hmm.
And then hone down your search by saying, okay, if I want to go to this place, when's the time of year that I should go?
Mm-hmm.
And where are the good places to go?
Mm-hmm.
And where should I stay?
Right.
All of those things you need to factor in before you even leave.
Right.
And if you do that right, then you'll know it'll help you at the end of the day. It'll help you in deciding what the heck to bring.
Mm-hmm.
Because, for example, if there's no opportunities to shoot small mammals and birds, then maybe you leave the big telephoto lens at home and you shoot the landscape types of things.
Right.
Now, so it'll help you there.
Right. Now, let's take a really specific example and talk about some of the things that we've done, at least theoretically. we're supposed to shoot at Big Sur sometime in the next couple weeks. I know that sounds vague, but there are reasons for it being vague, and we won't go into
travel
all of those.
Travel plans permitting, we will try to shoot there.
Yeah, we are going to be teaching a class in the Bay Area on a Saturday and Sunday here very soon. Of course, if you haven't signed up, I think there's still a few slots left in that, so you can still do that. But we will be definitely teaching that, and the thing that's in question about is whether or not we're going to be able to squeeze in a little sky side excursion to Big Sur and record a podcast there and all that good stuff. We're going to try.
We're going to really try.
We're going to try. But because of that, we have been doing some research and advanced scouting, so to speak.
Right. And first of all, I mean, we knew we were going to be in this area. So mm-hmm. we said, okay, we have an opportunity to, and this could happen with anybody. Hey, I'm on right. a business trip. Maybe I take an extra day
right.
and I can maybe do some shooting or whatever. I'm going to have an opportunity to go somewhere. Why did we said, okay, we're going to be in the Bay Area. The first thing we thought about is where would we want to go in there? There's a lot of things you can try
right.
to shoot in the Bay Area
right.
and you can't do them all in one day.
No.
So we had to pick something. And what drew us to the Big Sur area is, well, this was one of Ansel Adams' favorite spots to go.
Mm-hmm.
So we thought, well, you know, that'd be a great place to go. We could focus on doing landscapes. And if we focused on landscapes, then it means it's easier for us to pack our stuff because we don't need to bring quite so many of the big lenses and
right.
all that other stuff.
Right.
So I'm going to tack something on to a business trip perspective,
mm-hmm.
landscapes are a great opportunity for you to do
because mm-hmm.
you don't need to bring as much stuff.
Yeah, and we looked at differing things out there, but, you know, again, the reason that we picked Big Sur is, we had a good sense of, you know, what kind of subjects we could shoot there. I've been there before, on a fairly limited basis, you know, with business trips and things like that. But it also seemed like a pretty rich environment. You know, we could easily fill up a day and not run out of things. We considered shooting in some of the redwood areas around there too, and that would be fun as well.
Heck, you considered driving out to Yosemite.
I know.
That's a little bit.
I have done that before during a day, but, you know.
So what did we do? We said, okay, we're going to go here. We narrowed it down to the Big Sur area.
Right.
And then one of the things you want to do is you want to start looking at, you went out and you find a book.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, okay, maybe I'll go on Amazon or wherever, go into the Nikonians bookshelves on the website, mm-hmm. find some stuff that shows me images of that, and mm-hmm. find out where the areas are that I can actually go
right.
within that.
Yeah, and certainly I was doing internet searches as well. Now, one thing I ended up ordering, because I've used these a lot when planning shoots, is the Photo Traveler's Guide to that area. And this specific one is for Channel Islands National Park in California Central Coast. So it encompasses several different areas. But the photo traveler's guides, and you can just find them off of the internet, you know, by searching on Photo Traveler, are very nice. They're not that expensive. They're not particularly fancy. You know, they don't have color photos in them or even photos at all. What they do have are very good descriptions of the areas.
And they have some maps.
And they have maps, and they'll talk a little bit about what's there, when to go, where you can find, you know, particularly good shoots. It won't be the kind of thing that says put your tripod legs here, which I'm fine with personally because I don't really want to do that. But they'll give you lots of good information, and they're not too expensive.
Right,
but,
because time
but you
of
will
the
have
year,
to order them off the internet. You won't find these in bookstores.
Time of the year is real important. Mm-hmm. I'll give you an example. Bosque del Apache.
Right.
Well, if you went there in the summer,
forget it.
There's no it's hot and there's no cranes, nothing. You want right. to see the cranes, you've got to go there in the fall and the winter. Mm-hmm. So it's just a matter of being able to, it's not only what you want to shoot, but where you have to go and when you have to be there to
right.
shoot it.
Right.
What time of year and also what time of day.
Yeah. Now, you know, some other things that I've found very helpful, photography named Tim Fitzharris has published a number of books. He's a very good photographer just in general, you know, of landscape and wildlife subjects, and his books are a lot of fun to look at just for that reason alone. But he's got several that are really good for planning. There's one that I brought today that just to show Jason what it looked like. It's called Nature Photography Hotspots, and it's got a bunch of locations in the U.S. and I believe Mexico and Canada that, you know, based on certain subject matters, like he's got a section on brown bears, and place that he talks about there is Brooks Camp up in Alaska. You know, and there are some places in Colorado and you name it, they're all over the place. It looks like it even includes Central America too. And, you know, he'll have some of that same kind of information that you'll find in the photo traveler's guides. The difference is that he also has some really great shots too. So you can see exactly what kind of photos you're, you know, potentially able to get in a location.
Yeah, and I think it's important, especially with things like birds, mm-hmm. with the wildlife photography,
mm-hmm.
You need to find a resource that is designed with photographers in mind.
Right, bird watchers.
Because bird watchers, there's lots of birding guides and birding hotspots books. You can do a search for those. And
they're not the same.
They aren't the same. And what it takes to get good bird photographs is being very close to the animals themselves. And for a diehard birder, what's important is that they were able to see it through a spotting scope,
right.
or maybe just hear it in a rainforest. If you heard the bird,
right.
that you can check it off your life list. I know it sounds silly, but those of you who are birders, you know what I'm talking about. It's a different concept.
Mm-hmm.
Getting a good photograph of a bird is a lot more challenging than just being able to say you saw it.
Right.
So, finding resources that give you information on the animals and where they're really good. I mean, I've been to plenty of places where, you know, the birds are everywhere, but if there's no congregation area, like a bird feeder or some pond or something where they're going to come in at a certain area and not pay attention to you,
mm-hmm.
Times of year is important.
Mm-hmm.
You know, breeding season, animals are a lot less likely to pay attention to you because they're paying attention to finding a member of the opposite sex to hang out with.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all that kind of stuff where it's knowing when to find them, where to find them, and then how to shoot them.
Yeah. And he's also got a complimentary book on the national parks in the U.S. that's really, really good. Includes the same, you know, really nice photos and has even more detail about shooting locations, including some of the really famous spots if you do want to do some of those. And, you know, outside the U.S., there are equivalent guides around the world. You'll just have to search down a few. I've used some really great ones for Australia and other places that have equivalent information, but it really helps if you know what you're going to want to do when you get down there and where to go and at what time of the day.
Right. And now, speaking of time of the day,
mm-hmm.
if you're going to do landscapes, which what we're thinking about doing in this particular case, then it's important to know your sunrise and sunset times.
Right.
If you really want to get hardcore and start looking at where the sun actually rises in the sky, you can. There's resources online for that. But I think mm-hmm. at a minimum, you ought to at least have a fundamental idea of what time of day you're going to have to be getting up in the morning to get your sunrise light and your sunset light, because that helps you plan your day accordingly and also helps you plan where you stay. If you are staying somewhere that you've got 2 hours to get to the spot and you want to be there at sunrise and sunrise is at 5 a.m., you're going to have a fun early morning
because mm-hmm.
you're going to be getting out of bed really early and maybe you're going to rethink that. So the time of day is also dictated by the time of year. As we move into we're getting into spring and then the summer months, the sun comes up earlier and it sets later. So that can mean for some things, you're going to have not a lot of good light during the middle part of the day. So it's important to know, but that can give you a lot of time possibly to go between a different location. If you mm-hmm. want to shoot one spot in the morning and then you have several hours before you have to get to somewhere else, you can take a break and then traipse down the coast to go somewhere yeah. else for the sunset.
Yeah.
So it all just depends.
Now, you know, a lot of times in shoots, I've got a pretty good idea of what's going to work well at sunrise and sunset just based on information that's out there. But if I'm in a place that isn't as well publicized, one of the things I will do at times, and it's not as frequent as other things, but I'll, you know, get a topo map of the area and, you know, in conjunction with some of the sunrise, sunset information in terms of directions and a little compass, you can often figure out what's going to happen at a spot just by looking at the terrain and thinking about, all right, is the sun going to be blocked here or not? You know, where is it going to be positioned? Is that going to work well for my shot or not? And again, this isn't something I do frequently, but I do it. And it is a valid thing to
yeah. For example, if you're shooting in a
technique.
North-south running valley,
right,
you're not going to get any sunrise.
Right.
So no point in being there at oh dark 30 to try to catch that morning
you'll
light.
Just drive yourself nuts.
So maybe you choose a different spot, or you go, or you come back at a different time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, speaking of directions and stuff like that, once you get down to, you know, you've narrowed this down, you know basically where you're going. Now you get there. This is where it becomes a good idea to hopefully go to the spot that you want to shoot the day before.
Right.
And you want to at least, because that'll give you that idea of like, where is the sun setting? What is the topography like? Where are the features? Where are some spots that I might want to set up for in the
right.
morning?
Where are the trails? How long are they?
How long did it take me to get here from the time I parked my car?
Yeah.
Those are things that are important pieces of information that you really don't know until you get there.
Yeah.
So if you can get an extra day on the front end to scope out your spot, or go in the middle of the day,
mm-hmm.
hey, the light's bad, so what? You can come back later.
Yeah.
But now you know where that's important.
Yeah. And an example of this, I was doing a shoot in Shenandoah National Park last year, and I was able to get there late the day before and do some scouting. And you know, what I did, because Shenandoah National Park is predominantly up on a ridgeline, so you get this very clear separation between what works well at sunrise and what works well at sunset, depending on what side of the ridge you're on. And there's a road that runs right along the ridge. And what I did is I drove up and down it, and I actually had my GPS receiver with me. And if I spotted something that looked like a great location and would probably have the right kind of lighting, I marked it.
Ah, so you cheated.
I cheated, yeah.
But that's good. That's technology for you.
Exactly. And the reason I did that is coming back the next morning in the dark on a road that isn't all that well marked makes it difficult sometimes to find that spot. You can't see anything, or not much necessarily.
Right.
In low light, and a lot of spots kind of look the same until, you know, the light starts improving. So that really helped me. And the other way it helped me too is I had a realistic idea of how far away it was to that spot, so I could be sure to leave, you know, at the right time and not miss it. Because sometimes it's deceiving.
Now that's the high tech mm-hmm. way of doing it. I'll tell you the low tech way of doing this.
All right.
When I was at graduate school, we did field work, and we mm-hmm. had places in on the island of Trinidad where we would go tromp down into the mm-hmm. middle of the rainforest, and a lot of these trails weren't really trails themselves. They weren't maintained trails. They were just spots that we knew we could get down to the river mm-hmm. easily from. So we would just know in our logbook that the trailhead, so to speak, where we would park would be X amount of miles or kilometers past the landmark, in this mm-hmm. case, the landmark where the mile markers on the road, in on the island of Trinidad, the mile markers are these stone things that
right.
the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers put there, back during World War II when they were, when they were there, so that they would have mile markers. And so we'd say, okay, we go to the 18 3/4 mile marker, and then we know that it's, you know, a few hundred yards past that. And so there are other ways of doing that that mm-hmm. aren't as fancy
sure.
as the GPS unit.
Just if you have one, consider using
exactly.
it.
Exactly. Now, a compass is something that's very useful to have because mm-hmm. you can at least get an idea of where your sunrise and sunset are going to be. Mm-hmm. So that's a good thing to do.
Related to all that, I find the different software programs that are out there that do, you know, do mapping and more important, you know, routing and driving time calculations and things like that to be, you know, just a godsend for planning stuff, especially when you're thinking about needing to be somewhere, let's say 45 minutes before sunrise comes up. You can easily figure out what time you need to leave and all those kind of things. They're great.
Now, the last other piece is going back to the wildlife a little bit, mm-hmm. you know, talking about time of day. It's very important to understand when the, not only where they are, but when they're going to be there as far as,
and when they're going to be active
and when they're active. That's right. Birds are most active right around, the first few hours after sunrise and then not again really active until, right before sunset. And I find it tends to be easier. As much as I hate the morning, it's easier to shoot in the morning because you're gaining light. Mm-hmm. And you're always, the sun's getting high, you're gaining light right in the afternoon because depending on when the activity starts up, then you're always losing light as the day goes on. But you can shoot equally well in both at both times of day. But middle of the day, rarely are animals active. So
yeah, and you can certainly find them, but they're not very interesting. A lot of times they're kind of laying around, you know. Elk don't tend to be too active midday, for example.
Right. And you need to find spots where the animals tend to congregate because that'll give you an easier time of getting there. Mm-hmm. So from a wildlife perspective, it's not just the light because you don't often get to pick the location, but you can certainly see spots that might work. For example, if you're shooting in the morning, you don't want to be facing east. You don't want to be shooting directly into the sun. You want to try to at least position yourself in some spot and pre-visualize that and say, is there somewhere if I come to this spot where I can set up so that the sun will be at my back? So mm-hmm. I'm at least getting mostly predominantly front-lit subjects. Mm-hmm. And conversely, facing east in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. So it's those kinds of things that sometimes works. We'll see when I see a spot, I will look at it and say, okay, this would be a very good morning spot. Because I'm not going to be able to set up my tripod from the roadside or whatever in the afternoon mm-hmm. and have the light at my back.
Right.
So that's the kind of stuff that I look for when I'm scouting a location with wildlife in mind. It's where I can shoot with the sun at my back mostly.
Yeah. Yeah. And that doesn't mean that you can't shoot backlit shots of wildlife or other things, but it's going to be a little bit tougher. It's going to be a little bit tougher. You ought to go into that knowing that that's what you're going to have to do. Anything else on that subject? We'll have to talk about the equivalent for cities, you know, because there's some interesting things there too, but it's a completely different topic.
True.
Okay.
I think we've made it through.
All right.
So we'll bring you our photo prescription.
And this is a short and easy
one. Is my prescription to you.
It was, and I finally followed it several years later.
And, our advice for you this week is if you haven't done so already, get yourself a pair of knee pads. And not those cheap foam ones, but the ones that have the actual plastic hard caps mm-hmm. on the knees. I've had a pair of knee pads now for, I don't know, 2 years, 3 years maybe. Mm-hmm. They are a lifesaver. Mm-hmm. They're not terribly bulky to pack because they're flat. They Velcro. They're easy to wear. You can turn them around if you're not actually. I'll wear them sort of around my ankles, if you will, just when I'm walking around and hiking because it's a little bit less cumbersome. But they're very flexible, and when you are trying to, I think part of the problem with trying to try new
angles
and stuff, trying to get low angles, low shooting, is that if it hurts and it's uncomfortable, you're less likely to do it.
Yeah.
So something like knee pads can help a lot.
Yeah, and they'll also keep you from ripping up your pants if you're wearing some.
And they're a little bit of protection against water and mm-hmm. all the other good stuff, because usually they have a closed cell foam backing on them.
Now, the smart thing is get the ones that are kind of dark green, if you can find those, because anything that's light colored is not going to be light colored for long. So why not go ahead and get something that will blend into the dirt and grass stains and stuff that you're inevitably going to get.
Yeah, you can get knee pads at your local home improvement store.
Mm-hmm.
But I recommend going to something like an Army Surplus store mm-hmm. and finding some olive-colored ones.
And that's where I got mine.
All right. Well, so that's our tip for this week.
That's our podcast for this week, I think.
Okay.
Too.
So we made it. We got to the end. You guys are still alive, and we will see you in a couple of weeks, hopefully, from California.
We'll see how this works.
We'll see how it works out. And if not, we'll talk about how we wish we were in California shooting. No, we'll have other stuff for you. So don't forget to check out all of our episodes in our archive on the blog.nikonians.org website. You can find our show notes there with links to some of the products that we've talked about today. And as always, don't forget to check in and send us your emails, talkradio@nikonians.org.
And this will be the last time we mention the workshop in the San Francisco Bay Area. I think it's actually being done over in around Oakland, Hayward area. But you
sign
can
up.
Still register, you know, if you do it soon.
That way you can insult us in person.
That's right. And you just go to the Nikonians homepage, look up at the top for workshops, and it's the advanced digital workshop. Thing.
Yeah, advanced digital workflow workshop. Yeah. You'll see it. It has an ugly picture of us.
But there is a sister to it in Dallas in early June. That one is filling up too. But you've got a little bit more time on that one.
And these are actually 4-day workshops.
Right.
Mostly with Mike Hagen, and we'll be teaching part of those.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So
lots about printing, Photoshop, Capture NX, Lightroom, black and white. All sorts
point
of
out
stuff.
With the workshop, as long as we're mentioning it, mm-hmm. printing, they're going to be, they will have numerous HP B9180 printers. If you want to go to one of these workshops and crank out lots of 13x19, 12x18 prints, this is your opportunity to do so and do so in a color managed environment.
Yeah.
So, okay.
Good stuff.
Well, thanks for joining us. We'll see you in 2 weeks.
All right. Bye-bye.